da 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 cha. I do have some donuts left over still from the morning. So apparently not allowed to eat them in here, and I'm getting hum feedback. Oh.
You need to stand back.
Stand over there.
Oh, stand over there. I see. There we are. Yes. Oh yeah, your phones. Yeah, if I hear a phone ring, I will physically drag you out. And yes. But yeah, if you want a donut, please. An Nokia phone, right. So as they lovingly introduced me, I am Aaron Sayo, KDE developer. My slide says, yeah, I'm paid by Trolltech, but I suppose as of yesterday that's not particularly true, so I had to amend my slide. And this also this is also a great time to just remind you that this, in spite of the nice pretty picture on the top, my artwork is at the bottom, proving that I am not an artist. So if you feel offended by some of the diagrams you're about to see, don't worry, I realize I have no artistic talent. The scope of what we're going to cover today. Can everyone hear me, by the way? All right, good, good, good. So in KDE 4, we decided to take a look and see how we could revision the desktop experience itself. We looked at the panels, we looked at icons on the desktop, and we decided it was all crap and that we could do it a lot better for the modern computing environment. That is not what we're going to talk about today. However, in the process of doing that, be careful of those little, they slide out, those little tables. The tables are a lie. yes, exactly, designed to kill laptops. But out of this exploration, we had to write a whole bunch of infrastructure to allow us to do what we wanted to do. And this birthed a library called libplasma, which we used to actually design the desktop experience. And, you know, I was busy making what I needed to do what I wanted to do, which really wasn't to write this library, but to actually create a better desktop environment. And to my surprise, a few months into it, these crazy people that write a little piece of software called Amarok, you may have heard of it, came along and they were like, we want to make a better music, you know, player. We did Amarok 1, it was pretty good, but we're going to do even better. And we want to do these really cool, crazy things. Oh, and by the way, we're using your library. And I went, what? Because it really wasn't designed to be used by other applications at the time anyways, but now it is. So what we're going to be talking about is creating user interfaces with this framework that we originally designed for the desktop, but which is actually very generally applicable. So what we learned today, you'll be able to take and actually make desktop components for KDE4, but you can also do components for Amarok 2 or your own applications. So originally, this was going to be kind of an interactive, you know, we're going to write, you know, code together. How many people here have a working KDE4 development environment? Whoa, that's way more than I expected. But yeah, I kind of, talking to people over the last couple of days, it occurred to me that, you know, that might be the case, and maybe I would have to adjust my presentation. So it's going to be a little bit more of a traditional presentation. However, feel free to, interrupt and ask questions as we go. We're going to be taking a look at the code that we look at will be C++ and ECMAScript primarily. And we're only going to look at the essential API. LibPlasma has grown to be rather vast and large. We don't have time to cover it all. In fact, how long do I have? What time does this end? 12 or something? Or
12:20.
Excellent. You guys are stuck with me for a while. and I'm not sure who put that last line in there. That must have been after the third bottle of wine. Okay. So people often ask me, what sets the whole Plasma concept apart from the way we've done applications? And it's difficult to really understand unless you understand the principles behind it. By the way, excuse my slides. This is one of the beauties of open document formats. I originally did this in another presentation application, which decided today to stop working on my laptop. So I just opened it up in another presentation program. And thanks to open document format, ta-da! Except this should be up just a little bit more. That's pretty good. So the principles in plasma. We wanted something that was really, really beautiful, that was pretty. As you can tell, I'm not an artist, so the whole idea was to make it possible for people like me to make pretty, beautiful things. Consistency is also a high priority for us. In the design of it, I kept getting requests for people, you know, from people who want to do a desktop widget, and like, but I want my own background, and I want it to look very unique, because I'm, you know, a special diamond in the rough or whatever. And we kept pushing back and going, no, consistency is more important. And it's interesting, because as people have played with it, they really start to appreciate the value of consistency. Another basic principle is resolution independence. You're going to hear more and more and more about resolution independence as time goes on. Over the next couple of years, it's going to become more and more important. And the whole concept is that regardless of the device you're displaying it on, the interface will adjust itself to the size and resolution of the display. So you can make it as big as a wall, or you can make it as small as a phone screen, and the interface will actually adjust itself and shrink. We're mostly used to, these days, dialogues, right, with buttons and whatnot, and you click and drag them, and if you can make them smaller, what happens is the buttons go off, and they're now over there, and you can't see them anymore. What would be really cool is if I readjust a dialogue, that all the buttons and everything shrink to fit, so that I can just repurpose that same user interface. Yes. So this has a lot of implications. It actually turns a lot of how we do layout management on its head, but it's really important because our software needs to go in so many places these days. Another principle is that data is not display. And this is one of the harder things for us to shake in the software industry, especially the free software industry, where when designing interfaces and creating GUIs, we tend to put the data and the interface, you know, kind of meld them at the hip. And this has really nasty implications for software flexibility. So we're going to see how we've decoupled data and display. Shareability is also very important. We wanted to allow people to create things easily and quickly and then give them to other people, so that you could, you know, whip up some cool little thing and then share them with, you know, your friend on the other side of, you know, the continent. And they'd be able to just very easily start using it. It's kind of the social networking has been, you know, such a firestorm on the internet because people like talking to each other. We're social animals. And yet our software kind of makes us antisocial a lot of the times. And the things that we make, we often can't share with each other. And, of course, efficiency. Pardon me. More and more of us are using devices that run on battery. And what's interesting is that as our CPUs and GPUs have just skyrocketed in capabilities, our battery lifetime has basically done this. It's grown incrementally. So efficiency is very important when it comes to things like battery. But it's also important, efficiency is important when it comes to your time. Your time, you only have a certain amount of it, and eventually we'll all die. So that was kind of morose, wasn't it? So we have to value your time. And so we've tried to make it efficient to make things as well. So we're looking at efficiency from both the creator's point of view as well as from the computer's point of view and their battery lifespan. So we're going to quickly look at each of these principles in more detail. Beauty is important because if done right, we can get artists involved. Remember my I'm not an artist slide? Yeah, see, that's... I can't make something as pretty as that little icon up in the top. That wasn't me. That was someone else. And again, when we write software, oftentimes we make it very hard for artists to get involved. We expect them to be, you know, software developers, and they often aren't. But beyond just pictures, we've really been emphasizing a concept called organics. And the idea behind organics, in a nutshell, is that as a species, we've evolved over millions of years in this thing called the universe, and specifically on planet Earth. And we've optimized our being for this planet. So what's interesting is that our software often is very unnatural. It doesn't look a lot like or act a lot like the real world. And we wonder why people have troubles using it. It's because we're making a species that's optimized for the natural world. All those, you know, years out in the savannah trying to find things to eat and trying to avoid being eaten, And we're making them use software that's not very natural. So the idea of organics is to make software that reflects a lot of natural, real-world principles. So one of the examples I always use is that in the process of hunting or being hunted, one of the things that we most prey or predators have evolved is extreme sensitivity to movement. In fact, in the human being and most animals with eyes, movement is actually detected in the eye itself. You only need a two-layer neural network, right? Because you have the input and then the last input, and you just basically do an XOR and see what's changed. So part of the signal that goes to our brain from our eye is areas of movement. So we really respond to movement. This is really cool to use and exploit. However, it's very difficult to do because it requires animation. And how many people here are graphics programmers? See, even fewer than have KD4 development environments. That's how few there are. How many people have done animation in their application? Yeah, very, very few. How many people would like to have their application animated? The rest of you do, you just don't know it yet. So we wanted to make it easy to do animations. We'll actually be looking at how we actually allow you, with just one or two lines of code, create an animated moving interface without also being gaudy and annoying. Transitions are very important as well. In the real world, things don't appear and disappear. You know, we refer to people that do that as magicians, right? They do magic because it's not natural. It's like, whoa, how'd they do that? We want our software to be non-surprising. So transitional positions from one thing to another, as opposed to things just appearing or disappearing or magically happening. Roundness is another one. Most things in the natural world tend to not be hard and sharp-edged. In fact, when you usually see something that's has a hard edge, we go, oh, that's either, you know, some interesting mineralization that's happened, or more likely, it's a person has been here and has shaped this. So we tend to gravitate towards things that are round and soft and pretty. And at the end of the day, really, magic as an idea is bad. So Loop Plasma allows you to achieve a lot of these bullet points for beauty. Consistency. We achieve consistency by providing an API that we all can share with our components, regardless of what you're, you know, whether you're running it on Amarok or on the desktop. And it implements very common things that people would you'd normally have to do over and over again in your own code. So by providing a shared API, I can actually enforce a lot of consistency on your code as the developer of that library. We also provide access to shared artwork. As opposed to having to provide your own artwork, we actually have a theming system built into the library that's based on SVGs, we'll be looking at that in a bit, that allows you to actually share the same artwork with other components. And of course, there's the shared philosophy. By understanding the you know, Principia Plasma, we hopefully will encourage people to design things in a more coherent fashion. So resolution independence, how do we achieve that? Well, one is that we don't use bitmaps wherever possible. Obviously, when it hits the screen, it's a bitmap, but up until that point, we try and use vector graphics. In particular, we use a lot of scalable vector graphics, or SVG files, because they're very good at this. We can create one image file, and it travels well. So I'll give you an example of what I mean by that. So this might be the size that you'd run it on an internet tablet or what have you. This might be the size that you run it on my laptop. And it's the same image files, but they're actually resized on the fly to fit the viewable space. And regardless of the size, it's still playable. The same interaction is there. Yes?
It sort of falls down when you get minuscule.
That's right. There's the whole picture light issue when you scale down to very low.
Absolutely. And we have tricks for that. But this is the general idea. So with resolution independence, we allow the user to define what size they want things. So when we're creating components with Plasma, if at any time your code enforces some sort of a size, you're doing something wrong. Has anybody seen youredoingitwrong.com? Yeah. Go see it later. It's funny. I was almost tempted to use some of those ones, but some of those pictures, but I resisted. If you are enforcing size and not allowing the user to say, I want this element to be that big, you're doing something wrong. So in the case, for instance, of my clock here, if I want it to be, you know, that big, I should be able to make it that big. If I want it squished and not, you know, nice and square, I should be able to do it as well. That's probably a silly idea, but there we go. We let you do silly things if you want. And basically, it's a lot. It's putting the user back in control. Oops. So this really kind of changes a lot of how we do the software, because there's nothing is fixed. It's basically a fixed nothing, dynamic everything environment when we actually are putting our interfaces on the screen. And it takes a little bit to get used to, but you do get used to it very quickly. So the data visualization split. I'm trying to get through all these things very quickly, and then we're actually going to take a look at the API and start digging through code. The separation between data and visualization. This is, you know, who here has done MVC style programming, model view controller? How many people haven't? That's okay. Great. Okay, so as most of you know then, the whole idea is that you want to create a model for the data, and then you want to create something that visualizes it on screen or in some sort of an interface, and then you usually have something in between that helps mediate the two between each other, the controller. So this is really powerful, because it allows us to create an efficient data structure that we can sit off onto the side, and then we let the actual interface be developed aside from that. So if you want to change your interface or have multiple views on the same data or do these things, it's very easy to do. So we've actually got a common API for providing access to data that's actually optimized, and by optimized I mean simplified, for creating these kind of components. One of our main target user basis is people that don't program. We wanted to make it possible for, you know, average computer users to be able to make things. We talk about the democratization of technology often in free software and open source circles, and then we go around and we make it extraordinarily hard for normal people to do it. So when creating our model view split, we specifically kept to a very, very simplified data modeling system. And when we take a look at that, some of you may go, well, that's going to suck. I'm not going to be able to put my data into that. And you're probably wrong. We've done some very interesting and complex things with this very simple API. And the nice thing is it makes it very easy for other people to use it. And we'll see how that works in a bit. We also have a common API for visualizing that data. This allows artists or people that like to create just visualizations to create something to put on screen to display data, maybe you know, the heat of your CPU, or how fast the network traffic is, or what, you know, how warm it is here in Melbourne versus back where I came from. It was minus 48 with wind chill back home yesterday. I'm so happy I'm here. And what's nice about this is then we have this very nice abstract and a split where we can take any data source and plug it into any visualization. And the two didn't have to be created with each other in mind. So we're providing a common standardized API for those two pieces. We really create a lot of possibilities for the people that are actually creating components or widgets. And this allows us to tap into people that are domain specialists. So as an example, we have a fellow that's creating, he writes a data model for a data engine for weather information. And this guy like eats, sleeps, breathes. He actually, at work, he does weather applications. And it's what he does. And apparently there's a whole bunch of people out there that are just like totally weather heads, right? I know nothing about weather, other than I like it when it's warm. And but he's created this data engine that you can basically put in any city in the world, and it'll go out to an appropriate provider of data, whether it's the BBC or you know, Environment Canada or the NOAA or whatever, and actually presents the data, the weather data, which is really cool because he spent a lot of time parsing their formats, making sure it all works. And he knows what information is important. That's his domain specialty. And then artists can come along behind that, or people that want to display the weather, and they don't have to understand much about weather. They can just figure out a pretty way of actually displaying it. He's not a great artist, just like me. So he relies on other domain specialists in the area of visual art to provide that for him. So it's shareable. We designed this from the start to be very scripting friendly. We right now support ECMAScript and Python, although you can add virtually any language you want. We'll take a look at how that happens with Script Engine a little bit later. And the nice thing about scripting, besides being fast and efficient for the developer, is it's platform independent, because you're not compiling down to a specific platform. So I can take my little ECMAScript, cool little plasmoid thing, pardon me, and I can give it to anyone who also has libplasma on their machine, and it will work. It doesn't matter if you're running macOS or Windows or Red Hat Linux or OpenSolaris or OpenBSD, it just works. This is a wonderful, beautiful thing, right? I mean, the dream is to be able to take your component and put it on your phone or on your media center or on your laptop or on your friend's laptop. And to ease the sharing, we've created the idea of packages, and this is not competition with RPM or Deb or anything like that. It's a very, again, a simplified model for packaging up and then addressing into these packages for bits of data. And we'll take a look at the package system in a bit. We've introduced the concept of form factors, which allows us to take the same component, repurpose it into different places, and we basically tell the component that we're going to make, you are in this kind of environment. And then the component can adjust itself. And this is important because if I'm going to write something on my laptop, but you're going to run it on your phone, this allows me not to take that into consideration, per se, and the component itself can adjust. So it allows us to share things even across a disparate set of devices. And then we have something called DXS. The KD front end to it's called Get Hot New Stuff, which is exactly what it is. It's a way of sharing, uploading, and downloading bits of data that's application specific. So, for instance, who here has run KSTARS before? Yeah. And when you first start it up, right, it asks you, do you want to grab more astronomical data? There's a whole bunch of data that's available on the internet, astronomical data that we can't redistribute. So we use this distribution system to allow you to grab this information. Same thing with wallpapers, get a new wallpaper, you get a listing of wallpapers, and you can single click and it knows how to download it and install it and put it in the right place and set it as your desktop wallpaper. What's really nice with DXS is it's a full web service. If you go to freedesktop.org, you can find out about this, which means that we can provide searching, we can attach identities, either OpenID or PGP. And so eventually, the end goal for the KD desktop is that people will be able to create these really cool little components that can go anywhere. Then you can upload them, attach them to your identity, and you can share them with your friends. So your World of Warcraft clan can all have their little logo on their desktop or something. I don't know. You guys will figure out cool things to do with it. So how do we make all this happen? How do we make these things feasible and possible, and we don't waste a lot of your time trying to make you do these cool things? So libplasma is really component centric, or plugin centric, if you want to call them plugins. And this allows us to use this API in many, many different ways, in many, many different places. There's very little assumption of what you're going to do with it other than you're going to eventually display things on screen that are very cool. So these are the different components that we have. We have a data engine, which is used to acquire data. The names are kind of obvious, I'm sure. That's purposeful. The applet is the base class for actually displaying something on screen. So each component is an applet. So this would be a clock applet. This is an icon applet. This is a taskbar applet. This is a pager applet. Our battery applet. I knew the word would eventually come to me. Yes, it's C++. But you can bridge that over to pretty much anything that's worth writing in. My whole thing is if you can't bridge it from C++ to that language, it's not worth using. So to collect applets together, we have a component called a containment. We'll be taking a look at how this hierarchy works in a bit. And this is basically the manager for applets. We have animator, which is the central HQ for all animation that happens. And we'll see why this is very important later on. We have abstract runner, or runners as we call them, and this is a query matcher, essentially. It gets fed a user-supplied query, and then the runner will come back and go, I know what to do with that. And to give you an idea of why you might want to do that, there. So that was actually a calculator runner that's written in JavaScript that is calculating the value of sine 37. And at the very bottom, we have Script Engine. And this is the way we bridge the C++ API into the scripting world. One of the mistakes that often gets made, in my opinion anyways, when people create scripting support for an application is they kind of do a one-to-one literal translation between the API and the scripting environment. And this is, you know, often you want to have this one-to-one, right, because you want to provide a very powerful, you know, development environment. But when you're trying to create something that's very easy for people to use, average Joes, you often want to create an abstraction between, you know, the API. An API is to a programmer this, what a user interface is to a user, right? We try and avoid that whole interface follows implementation, right? You don't just because you have a tree data structure in your application doesn't mean you necessarily have a tree widget in your application. Interestingly enough, people often do this with script support because they have a tree data structure somewhere in their code. They then expose a tree data structure into their scripting environment. So Script Engine allows us to create an abstraction between the APIs that we're going to be learning about and the actual scripting. So when we take a look at an ECMAScript applet, it looks significantly different. And this is intentional. So there's a lot of other concepts as well that we'll be looking at, including packages, dealing with SVG data, toolbox as an example of a hover interface. And we also have a lot of standard widgets you can use, whether it's icons or little dial meters and bar charts and things. And we'll be taking, hopefully if we have time at the end, we'll be taking a look at some of those standard widgets. Oh, that didn't come out too well, did it? All right, I take back everything I said about open document formats. This sucks. actually, I'm pretty impressed that it came across at all. pardon me. So we're gonna start by looking at it kind of from the user's point of view on in. We're gonna work our way inwards. So we're gonna start with the visualization model. It's called Plasma, so there's a lot of puns in our code base and little in jokes. So the way it essentially works is the actual view itself is model view based as well. So we have a scene. Are there any game developers here? Okay, yeah. Yes, he smiles every time. It's like, animation? Yes, there's Ian. Game developer? There's Ian.
3D graphics.
Even. The 3D graphics. So a lot of games are developed with using a scene graph, right, where they actually have this model of all the objects that they're going to paint onto the screen. And then when they actually do the painting, they render or process this graph and actually present it. But all the actual graphical processing to actually make objects move and stuff, all the math happens in the model, not in the view. We do the same thing with Plasma. So what's interesting is if you look on my desktop here with my very large clock, this panel here, whilst and for some reason, Dbus is not happy with me today. So as you can see, I can, you know, the window passes between the panel and my desktop here. What's interesting is that these widgets down on my panel actually in the model are living just north of the widgets here. And that's kind of the neat thing about the model and view. In the scene graph, they're in different positions. Right, but when we actually provide a view on them, we can reorder them in any way we want. So we actually say, okay, let's show the desktop part physically on the screen here, then we create another top-level window, and we're going to show what we refer to as the panel components right here. So this allows us to be very flexible. We can even have multiple views. We can be showing the same thing in two places. In fact, that's how we achieve the dashboard effect. Let me turn on compositing so you can get the idea better. Hopefully my X doesn't crash when I do this. Good. So we allow people to bring their components on the KD4 desktop in front of their windows and then send them back. The idea is that it's a really nice way of having a workspace you've designed with all these widgets and stuff to support your workflow. But of course, you have windows in front of them. How do you get to them? Well, very easily, you press Control F12, and they pop forward. The way we manage this is that's just another view onto the exact same model. So we're actually, this is a top-level window, top-level widget, that is viewing the exact same space as what's on the desktop. So to the user, it looks like we're bringing it forward, and we're not actually doing that at all. What we're actually doing is showing a second view. And because, of course, they're viewing the exact same thing in the exact same coordinates, you don't see the difference. Visually, it's a nice trick. Yep?
Would there be some way to hide everything that's behind the windows on the desktop if that wasn't the case?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we could, but we don't need to bother. Exactly. And that's one of the nice things about these approaches is we get to take a lot of really cool shortcuts, right? We can do things in simpler ways. It's a more powerful way of developing. So there we are. So and if you're wondering what I'm running there, it's KWin, not CompIz or anything like that. So it's kind of neat. So the idea is that the model is what we call the corona, because as you know, the corona is where all the plasma activity on the sun happens. So we have this model called corona. And inside of the corona, we'll have multiple containments. So the desktop that you saw was a containment. The panel was a containment. And within a containment, you can have one or more widgets. And these widgets can either be free-floating, or they can be aligned or moved around and whatnot. And the containment defines the environment for the applets. We're going to be taking a look at constraints in a bit. And the containment defines all the constraints that are then applied to the applet that the applet needs to react to. And the containments themselves all live together in one big happy corona. Because it's a plasma containment, you see? It's a containment field. Yeah, so there's lots of groans happening. I know, I enjoy it. You know, if you have to write code, you may as well have fun doing it, right? So, does anybody have questions about this model first?
Can you take a containment and give other containments?
I'm trying to resist that. I'm not sure if I'm going to be successful in the long run. I'm trying to keep the development as clear and simple as possible, right, for people. While it's often really tempting to do complex and fun things from the framework side, I try and keep in mind that people are supposed to actually use this. So I try and keep things as simple as possible. So right now, no. And that's a purposeful decision. There's no real reason. I mean, for all intents and purposes, we could put containments in containments and it would work just fine. Oh, here's the other neat thing. Containments are actually just a specialization of widgets. A containment is actually an applet. So my clock here, go away. My clock here is actually a containment. So actually, I kind of lie. Yeah, that's already happening. But we treat it as an applet, not as a containment when it's in a containment. But if you want, you can set that clock as your desktop background, for instance. And you'll have a fully working clock that you can interact with and whatnot. I don't know why you'd want to do that. It's only a containment because I need something to test, and the clock is what I test everything with. So technically, we do have containments and containments, but we don't treat them as such. There was a question over here. Yes?
Containments?
No. So what you do when you're creating an application is you will create a corona, and then you'll set up one or more containments within that corona. So Amarok 2, their context view has become... who here has not used Amarok? Ever. Ian, you keep raising your hand. Every question. This is great. Okay, so in Amarok, which is this amazing media player, they had this context view, and it was shoved off to the side, right? And you could see the lyrics, the other songs by the band, other songs recommended by music, Last.fm. You get music brains data, yada, yada, yada. And everyone loved Amarok because of the context view. And so with Amarok 2, they were like, well, we should learn from that. We're going to put it right in the middle. So now the context view is this big thing right in the middle. And so they can do things like cover flow and all this other stuff. And what that center is actually a corona. And they have one containment, right? On the desktop, we obviously have multiple screens, multiple panels, so we need multiple containments. They only have need for one. So they create a corona, a containment, and then all the little context views, these little widgets and things, are actually the applets inside that containment, which is why it's kind of important. The first time I did this presentation, I skipped this whole step, and everyone was like completely confused how it went together. So I actually did a beautiful diagram, further proving I'm not an artist. Any other questions about this? Nope? Yes? Okay. So, you've probably already noticed that I've used the term plasmoid, widget, applet. What the hell's the difference? So, a widget is a top-level visualization. You'll know widgets from Mac OS X dashboard, Google widgets, Opera widgets, Yahoo widgets, Vista widgets. Everyone's into widgets for these days. So we call them widgets because we can actually support the vast majority of these. We already support Apple Dashboard widgets. That'll be out with 4.1. So you can actually run your Apple Dashboard widgets on Plasma. And 2 days ago, I got sent a screenshot of someone actually running Plasma as their macOS shell. So they had all their macOS, they had the macOS toolbar or menu bar at the top and all their OS X applications, but it was Plasma. And they're like, look what I did. And I was like, whoa, that's bizarre. but we want to support more than just our own things, because a lot of people have created these thousands and thousands of applets, right? So we'll be able to support Google applets, Opera applets. I'm hoping, I've only looked slightly at the Vista. The way that Vista's applets or widgets work, we can support the actual structure. I haven't looked at the full API for it yet. I have to look and see if it's going to be possible to bridge the API. But anyway, so we have this general concept of a widget. Oh, Super Caramba. We also support Super Caramba widgets already. So widget is a generalization of all these little top-level visualizations that you can put together and piece together to create your own little world. An applet is the native Plasma widget. In fact, it's the class that we use to actually put the display on screen. A plasmoid is a native Plasma widget that comes in a package. And the reason for that differentiation is that the package, as we'll find, may include SVG data, configuration interfaces, configuration definitions, multiple scripts, etc. So that whole package is called a plasmoid. And before you get angry with me about that name, that was actually a joke. Some were like, what are you going to call these applets? Because you can't just call them applets because Plasma's too cool. You got to have a good name for them. Like, I don't know, what, plasmoid? Pa. And then everyone started calling it that. And now I'm stuck with it. IRC is a dangerous place. So here's an example of an applet, clocks. Plasma's all about clocks. We have, I think we're up to 6 different kinds of clocks now. Yeah. And it was funny because when I was doing all the development of the library, I did a data engine for time, and then I did a clock. And so I had, the 2 pieces I needed. And so everything I tested was with and developed with was the clocks, was time. And so every screencast I did for, months was all about clocks. And so eventually everyone was just like, is Plasma going to do anything besides clocks? I was like, no. So in this applet, in this slide, you can see, you can freely resize. I already showed you that with the other clock. And what's interesting is you notice is that it actually, in the digital clock, it changes the size and layout of the text. It could also, if it wanted to, show more data. So the weather applet, for instance, it actually shows you, if you give it enough space, it starts telling you more about the weather. It assumes if you shrink it down, you don't want to know much. But if you give it more space, it's more important to you, and it can actually display more information. It starts telling you about wind directions and all this other stuff. One of the very important concepts is that there's this content area. And this inner content area is where you get to play. There is, and this is an accounting detail that happens behind your back, but there's also something that happens outside the content area. But you can pretend it doesn't exist. In fact, you should pretend it doesn't exist. And this is important because when we look at the API, which is on, the next slide, for applets, we're going to look at a whole bunch of methods that talk about content size and content size hint and et cetera. We don't actually deal with, when we're creating the applets, we don't deal with the actual size of the applet. We actually deal with the content size. And this is important because libplasma does a whole bunch of stuff for you and behind your back. For instance, it draws this nice little border. This nice little border is actually SVG data. So you can easily theme the results. So the Amarok theme that they're using is, of course, significantly different than the one we're using on the desktop. And in fact, Ivan Kuchik just yesterday released a really pretty SVG theme, actually. It looks really, really nice. But all of that happens for free and behind your back.
Those two images will have different aspect models, different size.
Sorry, which?
Those two images on the screen have different aspect models, different size.
They have different aspect ratios. Yes, they do. And that's something you can define in your applet. You can say, my applet should maintain its aspect ratio, or allow the user to, or we can ignore it. So the taskbar, for instance, you don't want a taskbar that has a fixed aspect ratio. You often want to make it longer, wider, as opposed to, taller as well. The round clock, we actually want it to generally maintain the aspect ratio. We do let the user override it. So on the desktop in Plasma, if you want to adjust aspect ratio free, the clock, you just hold down the control key when you drag. And vice versa, if you want to maintain the aspect ratio of your taskbar, you hold on the control key. But your app flash gets to define how we treat the aspect ratio. So now we get to, we have questions. Brilliant.
Do you have clipping things for backgrounds, you know, so you don't distort the artist's work?
That's a whole reason why the first thing here is the content. Jump to the actual applet. And that's exactly it. We do have clipping. Unfortunately, in 4.3, Qt 4.3, which is what Qt 4.0 uses, the clipping algorithms in the scene graph are crap. And it's not, I mean, they just never really pay attention to them. There's a really bad typo on that slide. They didn't pay attention to the clipping algorithms because they didn't think a lot of people would get a lot of use out of them. And then we went and we created this entire development environment based on the scene graph, and clipping is actually pretty important. So if you run the news ticker applet, you'll notice that your CPU might spike to like 30%. And the reason is because it's scrolling, you know, and the way the scrolling works is that it's actually just moving text widgets, but it's clipping them. And what's really funny is if you turn on, you can do in Qt, you can export an environment variable called Qt underscore flush underscore paint. And when you set that to a non-zero value, you'll actually see all the painting. It'll fill it in with yellow or orange depending on what kind of painting it's doing. So you actually see where you're doing too much painting. And what's funny is with the in 4.3, when you see the news ticker, it's repainting the entire where it would be if it wasn't being clipped. So that's why it's slow. But in 4.4, it's actually all fixed and it works good. Which is actually kind of the cool thing between Qt and KDE is that we push everything they do to the extreme limits. You guys in the games project are another one of those bastards who do this to us. But it's great because then it exposes all the problems and then we can fix them in Qt and make something better than ever. So content, yes. This is the geometry of the actual applet. And I think I forgot to do this setup before. I'm all confused. All right, you know what? I'm just going to put it on 4. There we are. And that's a little bit small still. Let me make that just a little bit bigger. That works. Is that still too small? Do I make it a bit bigger? No, it's good. Okay. I should have set this up before. My apologies. We have all the API documentation at api.kde.org, if you care to go there. Pardon me? There we are. We can read it.
Yes,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
And there is an alternative set BG back.
That's right. Yeah, Vim rocks. So this is the applet class. And if you don't like, I don't know, even though I have the API documentation, I always open up the header files because I'm just used to doing that. But this is actually, we've got nice HTML with diagrams and stuff up on api.kde.org. No, we actually use multiple inheritance quite a bit in libplasma, where it makes sense, anyways. So we have these content methods. We have a method to get the rect of the actual space of the content with content rect. You can ask for the size of it by calling content size. You can also, of course, do the same thing by doing, you know, content rect dot size. But we're lazy bastards and we don't like typing more than we have to. You can set your content size. You have to be careful about this one. You don't want to abuse this too much because, again, if you set a hard size, the user won't be able to readjust it. So why do we let you do this at all? Well, some applets need to adjust their width based on their height or their height based on their width, depending on the form factor they're in. So this allows you to do adjust your size. We do consider it a bug if the user cannot freely resize it and make it bigger or smaller. We generally say it's okay to adjust one axis. You basically have one axis of freedom, and then it's not a bug. But you can set the size of the content that you need. You can also provide a content size hint, which basically tells it when we put it into an automatic layout what size we should probably be thinking about giving it. And you also set a minimum content size as well as a maximum content size. And this allows you to basically say, don't make me any smaller than so many pixels because I really can't deal with that, or don't make me bigger than a certain number of pixels because I don't know how to deal with that either. So you can set some boundaries. But again, we ask when you're writing components using Loop Plasma to be very conservative with these. Use them only when necessary. So we have these content methods that we'll be using to actually define our, where our content lives. Yes, about aspect ratios. We have the ability to set your sizing policy. There's three methods. Actually, I only have two of them here because my slide's only so wide. One is the aspect ratio mode, and basically you can tell it to ignore the ratio or enforce an aspect ratio. We also have one called set remain square and remain square. And the reason was because we kept finding that people were creating widgets over and over and over again that needed to be kind of square in shape. They need to be width, need to equal height, like a circle, right? And so we had the same code being duplicated over and over again to enforce a square policy, so eventually I just gave up and added it to the API. You can also define the expanding directions. So you can say, expand. I'm being expanded in a layout, automatic layout, I want more horizontal space, or I can expand vertically, or don't expand me much at all. So where do you use this? Well, the taskbar, obviously, likes to expand in every direction it can, right? It's greedy, it wants to take as much space as possible. The battery applet doesn't. It doesn't want to expand at all, right? It just wants to sit there with its cute little size, and even if the layout says, I'm going to try and expand you, or there's room for you to expand, the battery applet does not want to expand. So it says, don't expand me in either direction. There we are. We also provide a lot of standardized ways of communicating various issues and states to the user. So we have fail to launch and needs configuring as two examples here. You can set fail to launch to true, and this provides a nice little message that you can provide to the user that overlays on top of your widget that says something screwed up. And again, this is the consistency issue. We didn't want everybody dealing with their own error handling and providing some interface for, because developers, we tend to, what do? Right? We have an error, we'll pop up a dialog box, or we will, you know, provide some really cryptic string that looks really ugly. So set fail to launch, it takes a Boolean, as well as an optional reason why it failed. And this allows us to do things such as OpenGL. You can use OpenGL to draw into an applet. And of course, not all systems have OpenGL support. So in that case, when you start an OpenGL context in your applet and it doesn't exist, Loop Plasma actually sets fail to launch to true and says, you don't have OpenGL, so I can't actually let this applet do anything. The other nice thing about set fail to launch is it stops asking your applet to paint. So you can actually assume that when you're actually throwing things onto the screen that things are okay. Things have happened, so you don't have to constantly guard against a lot of error conditions. You just set fail to launch to true and move on with your life. Needs configuring, that's another one that happens a lot. So for instance, we have a Twitter applet. Who here Twitters? Cool. It's microblogging. The whole idea is one-line blogs, right? It's really neat. But of course, when you first put your Twitter applet on your desktop, it doesn't do anything because it doesn't know who you are, it doesn't know your account, so you have to put in your account details. That would be a situation where you'd want to set needs configuring to true, and again, it does the same thing. It provides a standardized interface to the user to actually configure the damn thing. And the whole idea behind this is it does a couple of things. One, it allows us as the Plasma developers to improve these interfaces over time. It also allows the user to learn that there's a standardized way of interacting with these objects. So even if you made it, or you made it, or someone, you know, in the other side of the world made this widget, the user can come to trust and expect it to behave in a certain way. For configuration data, we provide two access methods, one for per widget configuration, and one that's shared by all the widgets of that class. So for instance, okay, that's right. I'm so not used to composite environments because I'm, you know, old. And so the whole moving of workspace, it throws me off. So an example of a per... a per widget configuration would be whether I want to show the seconds or also show the time in text. That would be per clock. I might want one clock that shows the seconds, another clock that only shows the hour, because I really don't care about it. Time zone, same thing. That's per clock. So I've actually got my local time back home here, but I've got my Melbourne clock here. An example of a widget global would be, for instance, in the weather applet. You can say whether you prefer your wind direction in, I forget what it is, knots or nautical mile or whatever it is, versus like real measurements, like, you know. Apparently for some people this matters. So they and what's that? Yeah, Bofin, yes, exactly, yes. it would have been fun back then, you know, 100, 200 years ago, inventing ways of measuring things. What are we going to measure that in? I don't know, how about my foot? Sounded like a brilliant idea. The tip of my finger to my elbow. Okay, so that you can set that, what kind of scale you actually want this data to be put in, and that's shared between all the weather applets. There we are. I'll learn to type one day. And what you get back is you get a kconfig group. And this allows you to set and read configuration data. You never, ever, ever, ever want to actually create your own config object. Because behind the scenes, what we do is we collect all the configuration for the applets, and we associate it with a given containment and a given corona, and this actually gets stored in one single file. The cool thing about this is that it allows you to actually take your entire desktop, or in the case of Amarok, your entire layout, and put it into one file that you can then ship halfway across the world and open up, and it will load everything. So we don't have to collect dozens of files. We don't have to try and guess where you, as a very creative individual, decided the configuration for your applet should exist. We know it's all in this one file. So what you can do is you, of course, create subgroups, right? So you get this group back, and you can create subgroups in there. So as an example, so this is generally how one might use the config group, right here. You get it back, and then you start reading things to it, and you can write to it. If you wanted to, actually another example here, probably a better one. So this is the default desktop containment, and it grabs the configuration as well as the global configuration and reads and writes a bunch of things. When it hands into the background or the wallpaper drawer actually creates a subgroup. And it's quite easy. You basically do this, hand it your parent group, which would be the config object that we just got back, and then we give it in, you know, whatever we wanted to call it. So you're not limited in any way by the actual configuration structure that you put on disk, which is good. So you always want to be using config and global config because, again, we're doing things in the background for you that are really important to the user experience. And this becomes a fairly, there we are. This becomes a fairly common theme when you're writing Plasma widget, yes? Oh, we have to switch tapes.